The Reverend Jeannie Gebrasi made headlines last summer when the then president, Donald Trump, wonder whatever happened to him, used the military to clear an area around St. John's Episcopal Church. That's in Lafayette Square for a controversial photo shoot. I'm delighted to say she joins me on the line now. A very good morning to you.
Good morning to you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for taking the time to be with us. What do you remember of those days back? I think it was on the 1st of June.
Yes, it was June 1st. I remember it really well because I am not the sort of person who has ever previously confronted riot police. This is not in my normal range of experiences. I remember it very well because it was before the riot police and the rubber bullets and all of that. It was a deeply moving day. It was thousands and thousands of Americans of every age and color coming together in a way that our country had not seen very much, which is so sad. A very interracial, very diverse group of people protesting the police treatment of people of color. It was deeply moving. And the contrast between what the day was like up until about 6:15 and then what happened was so shocking that I don't think anybody who was there will ever forget it. And watching what happened in the Capitol 2 weeks ago brought it all back. I could practically taste the tear gas again and feel the burn in the back of my throat, and watching again the difference between how those of us who were protesting the treatment of people of color, and then when white people were wanting to gain access to the Capitol, the way they were treated, those groups were treated differently, was just another shocking thing. So I remember the days of June 1st and June 2nd and June 3rd and the subsequent days when we just kept going down there. I remember very well and how deeply moving people of all ages, kids in strollers and people of all races and ages and older people holding signs that said, "I've been protesting since the 60s. Why haven't things changed?" It's very memorable.
Your speech of that day following that event was very memorable as well. Tell us about your thinking behind what you said.
You know, if I'm really honest, I didn't plan it at all. It's just what was so obvious to me, that what had happened was a sacrilege. It wasn't just wrong, and it wasn't just hypocrisy. To drive people away and off of church property, including church people, you know, I met this 56-year-old woman wearing a collar and a pink sweater, you know, to drive us off of church property with violence and terror when what we were protesting was the use of violence and terror against people of color. To use that for the president to stand in front of a church holding a Bible was a sacrilege. I didn't have to think about it. And it also was so clear to me that he had taken holy ground and turned it into violence, turned this holy ground into like a war zone. It was so clear to me. What started out is I just wrote a Facebook post, and I wrote the Facebook post for my friends and family who knew I had been down there to let them know I was okay, but what I had seen. And then I went to work on my virtual morning prayer for the next day. And at some point, my nephew texted me and said, "Your internet life's about to get strange." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Your Facebook post is getting 1,000 shares a minute." So clearly something I said and the way I said it struck a chord with people, or maybe the fact that I'm a white woman in my 50s, maybe it was in part, it was the messenger combined with the message, combined with the visuals that the entire world watched this. So what was behind it? I think also, Mike, years of watching the hypocrisy of what was leading up to this, years of being a voice for the white church and white America needing to stand up and call out the disparate treatment of people of color, and then watching it happen before my eyes, watching people dive for the ground when they heard the flash grenades because they thought that was live ammunition. The rubber tipped bullets. I saw someone right in front of me when I was wiping away the tears, literally from tear gas, washing out people's eyes. And I heard somebody say rubber bullets, and I looked up and there was a man whose shirt was pockmarked with rubber bullet indentations. You know, to see that and to have seen it coming for years, just this truth just came spilling out of me with very little filter, except that the people I know well knew that I must have put my swear filter on. It came out of me without a lot of swear words, which was a big deal.
Was what happened at the Capitol building inevitable?
Yes, I think so. Because years ago, former President Trump told us and showed us who he was. I remember thinking the summer before he became the Republican Party's candidate, I remember watching him mock on camera a reporter who had some physical handicaps. And I remember thinking that was the end of his candidacy because clearly he showed himself to be somebody without any human decency. And it got worse from there. He began to use the racist buzzwords and phrases and calling people at first vaguely to violence, and then eventually in his rallies, not even disguised, saying he hoped people would get beat up or, you know, threatening with lawsuits. I mean, he showed us who he was from the beginning. And as his presidency continued, his rhetoric got more direct, more clear, to the point that in the days leading up to January 6th, he was literally saying things and tweeting out things, calling people to arms and calling people to fight. So yes, I think it was inevitable. I think if you looked at social media in the days leading up, and I don't just mean if you're deep into Twitter, I don't even mean social media. If you read CNN.com, you read the New York Times or the Washington Post, there was so much reporting that showed that his followers were taking his calls to fight seriously and literally. So on the one hand, I was not at all surprised, but it was still shocking at a visceral level to watch the Capitol be overrun. And then also, I immediately noticed, well, where are the riot police? I don't see any rubber bullets. I don't see tear gas. I don't see police on horseback. I don't hear flash grenades. All those things were used against me and all of the people that were protesting to support Black lives. And yet this mob that's been saying for weeks that they were coming, giving pointers on where to hide weapons, they are literally overrunning the Capitol and nobody's doing anything. It's still hard to talk about.
This past week saw the election, shall we say, finally come to an end. It's a crazy situation you have over there. In this country, if you lose the election that morning, you are out of the building that evening and the new prime minister moves in. Over there, you have this long time where this goes on and on and on. Finally, Mr. Biden is now President Biden. Tell me your thoughts as you saw that happening finally.
The relief, the joy. I mean, relief is almost not strong enough a word to describe what it was like to watch that happen. And it's so intertwined with not just my experience of the last 4 years or my experience on June 1st or my experience since the election. It's all so tied together. But to watch him take that oath, or even the night before, to watch him and our now vice president standing at the Lincoln Memorial, looking out on that reflecting pool with those pillars of light, and for the first time, have a national leader call us to reflect on the lives that were lost to COVID, the nearly 500,000 people who have died, was profoundly moving, and I know you can hear the anger in my voice. The idea that that was the first time that a national leader had done that. The former president never did it. And whenever he mentioned the number of people, it was always somehow about him and how the numbers were being exaggerated or Fauci was out of his mind or whatever. He never took those lives seriously. I lost a parishioner in April. I went to her nursing home and gave her last rites through rubber gloves and a mask. She didn't have to die of this. My own mother-in-law died in July, and we couldn't be with her in the hospital because, in part, because of the political choices he made in this country to make it seem as if even believing there was a virus was somehow made you a crazy liberal, or the people who refused to wear masks because they said it inhibited their freedom. The insanity of that approach just became, again, more clear the night before the inauguration, when our new president and vice president stood there and spoke the truth about COVID, and didn't just speak the truth about it, but invited us to prayer and remember, and gave us this beautiful symbol of light on that reflecting pool with the Lincoln Memorial in the background. That's leadership. And we hadn't had any of that. So it's been a profoundly moving week.
I want to ask you this. What is the state of Christianity in the States, please?
So I was a lawyer before I was a priest, so I feel like I have to give you a legal disclaimer. My legal disclaimer is that I'm just a parish priest. Okay, there's my legal disclaimer. I'm not a bishop. I'm not a theologian. I'm a parish priest. But here's what I have seen developing in this country since even before I was a priest. Going back a few decades, Christianity in this country began to be represented as only one of two things, either the Roman Catholic Church or this evangelical Christianity that was the only Christianity really that filled the airwaves. So, you know, the Episcopal Church didn't have a radio network. And, you know, the Presbyterian Church or the Methodist Church weren't putting out Sunday morning TV shows. We didn't have a Rush Limbaugh. We didn't have a Christian industrial complex. And so to much of America, Christianity was either the Roman Catholic Church with all of its hoo-ha and its hierarchy and then its terrible scandals, or evangelical Christianity. And evangelical Christianity from the 1980s until right before President Trump, former President Trump, had become really what the media referred to as Christianity believes this, or the Christian position is this. And it was mostly about things not to do and who Christianity excluded, like people who were gay, or women in leadership, or abortion. You know, it was Christianity became all about who would God hate? Who do we hate? Christianity was then also deeply connected with the Republican Party. And those two groups, the Republican Party and basically white, I shouldn't have just said evangelical Christianity, white evangelical Christianity, got tighter and tighter together and pulled each other farther and farther into an extreme and began to take on and equate Christianity with patriotism, with American nationalism and exceptionalism. This is then what President Trump and some religious leaders didn't just exploit, but fed and exploded. Behind the scenes all this time has been the rest of American Christianity, the Black Church, which I hate to say, but the reality is that in the United States, Sunday is the most segregated day in the week. But the Black Church has been the institution to hold on to the closest representation of what it means to follow Jesus, to preach the gospel, to be a church community, to be the closest thing to a beloved community that this country has. The African American church in this country has kept the church alive. Because my view of Protestant Christianity, mainline Protestant Christianity, which includes my own, you know, the Episcopal Church is the Church of England here in the US, has been for decades pretty silent on issues of Black lives or income inequality or immigration or any of the issues that it's so clear that these are things that Jesus cared about in his own life. Mainline Protestant Christianity, I felt like, had lost its voice, had ceded its voice. So Christianity in this country is a mess right now because the predominant Christianity that most Americans see is now tied up with Christian nationalism and Christian exceptionalism and an idolatrous worship of Donald Trump that people think is true Christianity. And the fervor that is built when you unite religion with political power is very dangerous. And in fact, that's what killed Jesus, is the uniting of political power and religious fervor. One of my deepest hopes is that part of what I saw happen this summer in the US, when white people woke up in ways and numbers that we hadn't before, to what our siblings of color had been telling us for decades, if not centuries, we have woken up. And my prayer is, so has the white church. Now, my bishop was on CNN. My bishop was on Anderson Cooper. My bishop has been out there, and I am so proud of her. And our presiding bishop, Michael Curry, is also a total awesome badass. Now, you probably can't say that word. He is awesome. And there are some religious leaders who have been bold to speak about the value of Black lives and the value of inclusion and living a life of love. And what does that look like? And that, to me, is a sign that God is doing a new thing. And I am sorry that it has taken the white church 400 years to wake up. You know, I read once that the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago, and the next best time is today. So we didn't show up 400 years ago, but we're showing up today. And I was literally telling people that on June 1st, when people were saying, we're so glad to see you here. We're so glad the church is here. And I was saying, you know, I'm just glad we're here. I'm sorry it took us 400 years, but we're here now. And I am here now. And my colleagues are here now. And there's a whole wing of American Christianity that doesn't even know that progressive Christianity exists, that wants to cast Joe Biden out of the Catholic Church, or doubts that Pete Buttigieg is a real Christian because he's gay. And it's like, well, so what? There are millions of Christians in this country for whom that's just a nothing burger. Great. That's good for him. I'm so glad he's married and has a happy marriage. Yay for him. There are vast numbers of Christians in this country who don't have any idea that we exist or would think we were fake Christians. And that's our bad. We have not been preaching the gospel. We have not been living the life of speaking the truth in love. We have not been that. And that's also part of the fervor behind my real willingness and passion to speak out about what happened on June 1st.
How did you come to faith?
Just going to church as an outsider, actually. We didn't go to church when I was a kid. I would go with my friends who were Catholic when I spent the night at their houses, but I would have to sit in the back because, you know, I wasn't Catholic and I couldn't take communion. But there was something about the space, something about the words that weren't familiar to me, something about just the experience of being in church felt holy to me. And when I was in college, I realized there was an Episcopal church just down the street. And one night I went and I realized I had people too. You know, I had been baptized in the Episcopal church. And the idea of finding a place and a people where I belonged was transformative to me. So I came to faith through just the experience of worship and being an outsider, and then finding that, no, I'm not an outsider to God. It's humans who divide us all up into insiders and outsiders. But to God, we all have a home. And I found mine in this world. And it was only decades later that I learned more about how my expression of Christianity allows me to have intellectual and theological freedom and question things, and the freedom it gave me, and the beauty and the simplicity and the complexity and the paradox was just profoundly real and moving and vital to me. But I came to it as an outsider, and then learned that to God, none of us are outsiders.
It don't matter to the sun. If you go or if you stay, you know the sun is gonna rise and shine down on another day. There'll still be a tomorrow, even if you choose to leave, 'cause it don't matter to the sun, babe, but it matters to me. It ain't gonna stop the world. Walk out that door. This old world will just keep turning round, turning round, like it did the day before. You see, to them it makes no difference. They just keep on keeping time, 'cause it ain't gonna stop the world out there, but it'll be the end of mine. What can I say? What can I do?
And there are some religious leaders who have been bold to speak about the value of Black lives and the value of inclusion and living a life of love. And what does that look like? And that, to me, is a sign that God is doing a new thing. And I am sorry that it has taken the white church 400 years to wake up. You know, I read once that the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago, and the next best time is today. So we didn't show up 400 years ago, but we're showing up today.
What can I say? What can I do? I'm still in love. So while you it don't matter to the moon, if you're not in my life. No, the moon will just keep hanging round, hanging round, like it's just another night. Find another place to shine down on some other lover's dream, 'cause it don't matter to the moon, babe, but it sure do matter to me. it don't matter to the moon. No, babe, but it matters to me.